Thank you for the invitation to be here. So I believe that many people in the audience are physicists. I'm a mathematician, and I can't hide it, right? My interests are going to be more concerned with how you actually my interests are as much with how you actually prove things as it is with how to use them and okay. So, starting off, random matrix theory. So, a random matrix is, of course, have entries MKJ. Random matrix is, of course, a matrix whose entries are random. And there are many ways, many, many different ways of choosing what class of matrices you're looking at and how to put some kind of probability distribution on the entries. So you could have, for example, matrices which are self-adjoint. I mean, I think physicists use a different symbol for this. This is MJK bar. That's the KJ entry. And a different situation would be to have matrices M, which are real and symmetric. Different ensemble. Different case of M, which are permission, and also what are called self-dual. I'm not going to make that precise. All of these are N by N. First, and the third is here. These matrices will be N by N. Here they'll typically be of even order, 2N by 2N. And I'll have the additional property that M equals J, M transpose, J's. It'll look like this, where J is your matrix with 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, something like that. It's additional property. These are permission self-dual matrices. You could also have distributions where instead of M being a Hermitian matrix, M could be a unitary matrix. Unitary. Or it could be an orthogonal matrix. And so on. So you have the idea that one could look at all different, as one would say, on ensembles of matrices. And what I'm going to be looking at almost exclusively in this talk is a particular kind of ensemble of unitary matrices. We will be concerned so-called unitary ensembles.
So the matrices are unitary?
Now I'm going to explain that. Okay. So-called unitary ensembles. This will refer to the symmetry properties of the ensemble. That is, N by M. Self-adjoint, and as entries MKJ, the real part of MKJ plus I times the imaginary part N by N, equipped with a distribution which looks like this, P of N dm, which is given by the determinant of WNM, and I'll explain this notation dm with some So let me do the easy part first. This is a normalization constant. WnX is just a real valued function, which goes to zero rapidly enough as x goes to infinity. And what I mean by WnX, it's the functional calculus. WnM is the functional calculus. So for example, if Wn is say e to the minus x squared, then Wn of m is just e to the minus m squared. Now, what dm is the really important thing. Dm is Lebesgue measure on the algebraically independent entries of m. So in detail, what dm is the product of dm kk, k running from 1 to n, times j less than k, d times a real part of m jk, times the product j less than k times the imaginary part m jk. So you just take all the entries of the matrix, put Lebesgue measure down on it. Now this is the real guts of what is happening for reasons which I'm going to explain later on. Of course the issue is that this does not give you a normalized probability distribution. So what you do is you put on this factor here, which you should think as a renormalization factor or a convergence factor to make sure that you have a finite measure. And also you want the finite measure to have all moments finite. So this goes to zero fast enough. The interval of m raised to any power, say L, P of n dm dm should be finite for L equals 0, 1, 2. So this must decay sufficiently rapidly. This should be thought of just as providing a renormalization factor. Now, a really important idea is that if one thinks about things in this particular way, and one introduces this factor W just to make things finite, I'm sort of indicating that there shouldn't be much physics in the choice of WN. And in fact, large part of the mathematical theory of random matrix theory, we will be speaking about this a lot as the morning goes on, is to show that the statistical properties that you're going to compute are going to be actually independent of your choice of Wn. That's known as universality. Statistical properties.
So I will take exponent instead of Gaussian and let it work. A lot of properties will stay.
Right. So statistical properties in the right scale, independent of choice of Wn. Okay. All right. Now, this is sort of our first part. Now, how does one use random matrix theory? Much of the interest in random matrix theory is due to the fact that an enormous variety of phenomena, everything from scattering theory in the theory of neutrons all the way to the zeros of the Riemann-Zeta function on the critical line, seem to be described by random matrices. There's an extraordinary variety of phenomena. There's no a priori reason for this at all. And it's extremely interesting to read. Of course, it was Wigner who introduced these ideas into theoretical physics in the 1950s. And it's extremely interesting to read his papers from that time, where you see he's just introducing random matrix theory as a model on the basis of certain symmetry considerations. If we have enough time, I can describe what that situation was like, and he's left an ample record of what his thoughts were, which led him in this direction. But there's no a priori reason why random matrix theory should be such a useful model in so many different kinds of phenomena. I want to mention just a few, but let's make this a little more precise. Is that what do we mean, or how does, or what do we mean? I mean by saying that a system is modeled by random matrix. What does it mean? The situation one is dealing with is one has some collection of data, say on the line, it could be on the circle. Call these points AK. And suppose they're centered around some point A, and there are a lot of them. And we want to say something about the statistics of this set of quantities. Maybe we were interested in questions about what's the probability of a gap, that there are no eigenvalues in a gap. Maybe we can be interested in what is the nearest neighbor spacing distribution for this collection of numbers. So we got these things. On the other hand, we could have some random matrix. This is some data. On the other hand, we could have the eigenvalues of a random matrix. And maybe those sitting over here, lambda k, and they're sitting around some energy E. Now what one always does is one takes the, shall we say, one utilizes all the freedom that one would have in a experimental laboratory, as it were. So what do? You should think of yourself in the following situation. You're trying to investigate some phenomenon on a microscopic slide, on a microscope slide. What can you do? The objects you're looking at are on the slide. You can take that slide and you can put it into the microscope. The freedom you have is just adjusting it so it's right in the center, so you can center. The next thing you can do is you've got the focus. So you can adjust the focus, and you adjust the focus so that you have one phenomenon or one bacterium or one whatever per unit inch, per unit length. Once you've done that, your options are up. You've got nothing more that you can do. And that's what's called unfolding the data. So you unfold the data. And unfold the eigenvalues. So by that I mean you center them, AK minus A, and you multiply them by some scaling, gamma A. Center them, multiply by gamma A to ensure that you the expected number of data points per unit inch is 1. You do the same thing with the eigenvalues. Once you're in this position, the game is up. Now you must just look at what you get. And you will find that the statistics of these AK tildes is exactly the same as the statistics of the lambda K Okay, so if you find that you say that the system is modeled by this particular ensemble of random matrix theory. That's what you mean. Some statistical collection of objects, and you compare this statistics on an unfolded scale with the eigenvalues of a random matrix. You could be having to use a completely different scale for the two different sets, but that isn't the point. Once you've made this choice of scale, in both cases, so the expected number of events or expected number of eigenvalues per unit tensor is 1, you're done. And then you have to compare. As it were, you take out your book, your Abramovitz and Stegen, as it were, of random matrix ensembles, and you look to see if the two statistics agree. Now, the really extraordinary fact is how many systems were modeled in this particular way. So to make...
some sense, it's not completely surprising if you have something which is robust mathematically and is universal over rather broad range of classes of models.
But why should the fact that it is...
systems are ultimately, presumably...
Is that a religious statement, or is that a statement about physics?
It's a statement about experience with physics.
But
actually, within some situations, if you have a separation of energy scales or length scales, then
how do you include in
context? And then
how do you place within this context the zeros of the Riemann zeta function? There's something much more going on, but I think you're on the right track, because if one wants to think about things in the following way, that physics can be modeled by mathematics, then this experience which you're talking about of seeing universality arising in physics must have an analog within the mathematical operations which describe it. You don't necessarily have to use those mathematical operations to prove these facts about some physical system. You could try to use these facts and prove something about a mathematical system. But underlying it, and perhaps that is something about what is going on. Okay. One could take one step back. From the way I understand it, it's really, if you think about any kind of physical system, unless you admit that there's something like universality present, you have no chance of there being even a concept like physical law. You can't say that you have the second law of thermodynamics, for example, if such a result would depend on the microscopic interactions between the particles. So just as one experiences at the macroscopic scale, universality, which is the same as a statement that there are laws of physics, and one imagines that mathematics can describe this, there should be something of what one can call macroscopic mathematics, that there should be a certain scale on which large numbers of mathematical phenomena look alike, and that is also something. So, giving some examples, let me take some examples. You've got some uranium, U-238, and you're sending in some neutrons at some energy E. And you look at your cross-section for scattering, and you get these famous diagrams that look like this. K plus 1. Get these resonance peaks. And the issue was, how does on the end, there will be hundreds and sometimes thousands of these peaks. No hope to analyze it either analytically or numerically. You need some kind of model. And Wigner came up with a model that these should be described. These EKs, which you can now think of being these AKs, should be described by random matrix theory. It's an inspired guess. And indeed, that is what has been found to an extraordinary degree of accuracy. So let's just put on Wigner here. So just one more time, let me say it again. You take this data, you unfold, and then you compare it. In this particular case, you compare it with what's called the orthogonal ensemble, which would correspond to such matrices. A different example would be, you take, as I say, there is a half, here is the S-plane. You take the Riemann zeta function, as it is, and you look at the zeros here. These are 1/2 plus I gamma k, assuming that you have the Riemann hypothesis. And then you unfold the gamma k tildes, and you find, and this was a discovery initially due to Montgomery, an extraordinary accuracy. And it's really, if one is an applied mathematician and you see the comparison between data and experiment, you believe you're in nirvana. It's just unreal how close the approximation is for the statistics of these things
as compared
to the statistics of the eigenvalues from the unitary ensemble. So what Odlyczko did is, he's got this wonderful paper with the name is on the 71 million zeros of the Riemann zeta function, starting with the 10 to the 21st one. That one can even make sense of that is an extraordinary fact. And since then, after Bell Labs basically closed down as a Or this part of it closed down. He was given a long period of time just to do more and more calculations. So it's gone beyond the 10, 20, 30, so something like this. Let me just give one more example to give you a sense of it. This is a card game called the patient sorting. So you play the following game. I'll give you a deck of cards, N cards, which you number, say, from 1 up to N. 1, 2, 3, up to N. You shuffle them. The shuffle you think of as a element in the permutation group. And you play the following game. You take the top card, and I put it down on the table to my left, face up. I take the next card. If it's smaller than that card, I put it on top of it. If it's bigger, make one more pile to my right. Take a third card. If it's smaller than either of those two cards, I put it on that card. If it's smaller than both of them, I always go as far to the left as I can. If it's bigger than both, I make a third pile, and so on. So there's a game, and what one can show. So the question is then, how big a table do I need to play this game? In other words, how many piles do I get? So you've got Q and pi is equal to the number of piles. So pi is an element of the symmetric group. So that's my shuffle. Given my shuffle of with n cards, I'm going to end up with Q and pi piles. So I think now that SN has got uniform distribution, in other words, 1 over n factorial for each permutation. I ask, what are the statistics of this? Not only what are the expected number of piles, but what are their fluctuations? Then you find that if you take Q and pi and you center it, so this is our centering, what would correspond to A over there. Then there's a scale of n to the sixth. And you ask, what's the probability that this is, say, less than equal to some number t? Then this will go to something called f of t, which is called the Tracy-Widom distribution. Tracy-Widom distribution. And gives you the distribution of the largest eigenvalue of a random matrix. Of, in fact, one of the kinds we're dealing with. So the number of piles in the sorting game is described by the largest eigenvalue of a random matrix. So I just want you to have at this stage the sense that these problems are coming from everywhere. There's no a priori reason why this is going on. One can try to develop some kind of intuition about these things, that's what we hope to, that's what one always hopes to do. But so far the examples are coming faster than one's ability to really think about these things in any kind of broader framework. Okay. Yeah.
Where is the core of the problem that all this is eternal?
Is what?
Eternal?
No. Because if you've got a free fermion theory, you're only basically looking at e to the minus x squared. You're looking at one particular weight. And the phenomenon are much more universal than that. It really goes beyond that. Yeah?
Did I understand this question right? That you essentially point out that the fact that we can extract all these symmetries from the different laws, it's connected to the fact that you describe the nature of the total of mathematics. So it does not necessarily mean that there is this symmetry in nature, but you say that there's something that comes out of the mathematics with which you describe.
That is my... I'm saying this, is that mathematics is one story, and physics is some other story. And both these stories have a common element. And that's where my thinking is, and I don't quite know how to go from there. Am I answering your question how I feel about it? I wouldn't want to say it as true. I would make it more removed than the way you are placing it. Okay. So let's go back. So why unitary? So now we're beginning to analyze this particular ensemble over here. So why unitary? The ensemble of matrices is an ensemble of Hermitian matrices. So why is it called unitary? It's just simply this, that if I make a transformation M to M prime, which U, M, U star, U is a unitary matrix, then P of N, M, the M, is equal to P, N, M prime, the M prime. So the distribution is invariant under conjugation by a unitary. This is something which really has a very clear physical basis, because matrices, of course, don't mean anything in any invariant sense. They're representations of operators in a particular basis. This is really saying that the facts we are looking at are independent of the basis we use to represent the matrix, and really it's a statement about the finite dimensional operators that they represent. This is why they call unitary orthogonal for similar reasons. Now, what one does, we see that the quantities we are focusing on are the eigenvalues of the matrix. So M, we're just looking at this case, has got eigenvalues. Put it this way, bigger. Equal to. And these are random. Just as the matrix. Random the eigenvalues. And the key question is this. What is the distribution for the lambda case? What distribution does it inherit? Now comes one more of these unexplained, not completely unexplained, but a little bit mysterious facts, is that what you can do to get the distribution of the lambda code, you take the matrix M, which has a spectral decomposition, the emission matrix, which has
spectral theorem,
lambda I's are real, look like that. And we now think of this as a change of variable. So in other words, you map M to its eigenvalues and its eigenvectors. there's some ambiguity about this. It could be that you're dealing with a situation where you have two equal eigenvalues and you don't know what you mean by the eigenvector. Also, once you've got the eigenvectors, assuming that all the eigenvalues are distinct, so all the eigenvectors are determined up to multiplication by a phase. So this map is not quite well defined unless you take into account those two facts that I mentioned. So we should really map this onto is unit trees factored by the torus to take out the exponential phases. But let me just put it formally like this. And now you can compute the Jacobian. So you're changing variables from the m's to the lambdas and the u's. And a very remarkable thing happens. You'll find that it splits. So formally, I'm writing it like this. So the statistics that you put down statistics you put down on matrices by saying that you just have the Lebesgue measure has the wonderful property that it's telling you that the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of such a matrix in this ensemble are going to be statistically independent. So this means that if you ask a question, about the stats of the eigenvalues and integrate out the u's. Integrate it out. And you find that you get the following distribution. I'll write p hat of n lambda. The n hat is again a normalization factor times the product of the lambda I along with lambda j squared f and j n lambda. This is v of lambda squared, it's van der Mond. So this is by now a very famous distribution, and it contains within it the very essential idea of repulsion. So you have repulsion from the following point of view, that if I ask you what's the probability that two eigenvalues are going to be close, well, that gets smaller and smaller. The closer the eigenvalues are together. So there's natural repulsion built in. And this is an important part in the heuristics of the whole business. If I just put a set of particles down on the line uniformly, I have Poisson statistics, and I can have them bunching up or with big gaps. But what's very special about the eigenvalues of a random matrix, they give you a particle system, or what one says, an interacting particle system which has repulsion built in. And I should say that more generally, and I'll say what I mean by more generally, you get something which is the van der Mond to the power of beta. So beta equals 2 corresponds to the unitary ensemble. If I had beta equals 1, that would be what you would get from the orthogonal ensemble. If I took beta equals 4, that's what I would get from that symplectic ensemble. The symplectic ensemble is the one which corresponds to Hermitian self-dual matrices. These are very special values of beta, and beta should suggest to you a inverse temperature And if you take this object here and you write it as an exponential, you have a potential here for a log gas, right, e to the log, at an inverse temperature beta, where beta is 1, 2, 2 or 4. So Hermitian matrices are in between the symplectic and the orthogonal case in terms of repulsion. And this idea that the eigenvalues naturally repel each other is an essential part of these, what you now can think of as being interacting particle systems. Interacting particles. And you remember, it's on the basis of the statistics of the interacting particle system whether you can say your system is described by Riemann by random matrix theory, or this one, or that. These are the objects which are the physical objects you use to compare. Just to give you a little bit of a concrete sense of what's going on, I'll take the simplest non-trivial example. Let's take
matrix
to be a real matrix, which is symmetric. So, I want to verify this one over here for you in the simplest case, which is n is 2, so you get a sense of how things work. We've got here that m is u, lambda 1, 0, lambda 2, u. And u we can think of as being cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta. So it's 2 by 2 Hermitian matrix. We then have that A is equal to lambda 1 cos squared theta plus lambda 2 sine squared theta. B is lambda 1 minus lambda 2 cosine theta sine theta. And this is lambda 2 cos squared theta plus lambda 1 sine squared theta. So here is the change of variables. And we can compute the Jacobian, BABC, lambda 1, lambda 2, theta. And what you get is cos squared theta, sine squared theta, 2 lambda 2 minus lambda 1, cos theta, sine theta, cos theta, sine theta, minus cos theta, sine theta, lambda 1 minus lambda 2 times cosine 2 theta, sine squared theta, cos squared theta, 2 lambda 1 minus lambda 2 times sine theta, cos theta. So that's what the matrix is. If we take the determinant, that's absolute value, taking the absolute value of this being in determinant, and now you see the interesting thing happens. Lambda 2 minus lambda 1 comes out as a common factor from the last column of the determinant. And this is just lambda 2 minus lambda 1 times some function purely of theta. So you can see in your hand how the separation is taking place between the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors.
Power
1 comes out because you're in this case over here. So it's a little bit of fun to do it with the 2x2 Hermitian matrices, and you'll see a power squared coming up, but more generally one should prove things. So understanding that the application of random matrix theory is going to be mostly through the behavior of its associated IPS, interacting particle system, we want to now begin computing different things about the statistics of these. Now, the wonderful thing about these ensembles is that they're amazingly amenable to computation. Any statistical quantity you want, any reason why somehow you can always compute some closed form expression for what you want. But let me come back to that. So let me write up two universality theorems. And this will capture some of the sense of what we were speaking about. First is bulk result. Something taking place in the bulk. Say what that means. So pick an E such that the density of states at E is positive. Now, the meaning of the density of states is the usual physical meaning in this particular case. Now, then there exists a scale which will depend on E in general, such that probability of E minus S upon chi n E plus S has no eigenvalues. In other words, this probability that there are no eigenvalues in this window has got a limit as n goes to infinity, which has a universal form, 1 minus, you come to want to describe this, so k infinity, the so-called sine kernel, sine pi, minus 1. So here's an operator with this kernel. It acts in the usual way, and now it acts on functions which are in L2 of the interval from minus S to S. So think of this as an operator, an integral operator. There's its kernel acting on functions defined in the interval minus S to S. This is a trace operator. I can compute the term. There are explicit here for finite. This one over here, it's expressible as famous result is expressible as a solution to finite equation. The famous work of Sato, Miwa, Jimbo, and Weno. I think so. Okay. Now, I haven't put in any assumptions here, but this is actually a theorem now for. For example, if I take Wn of x equal to e to the minus, let me put q. So, and here, equal to alpha. X to the 2m, that's lower term, positive. In other words, if I pick w to be e to the minus some polynomial, also, if q in of x is just real analytic on r, and qn over the log of x.
Just saying
that qn grows faster than any faster than a logarithm, which means that e to minus it falls off faster than any polynomial. In both of these two cases, you can actually prove this theorem. Now, I ask you to notice in particular that there is no mention in the answer at all of which q you have chosen. The answer is completely universal. The thought in the back of my mind is we had the scale, this centering and scaling. Once we'd done that, once we had played with the microscope as much as we could, the game was over. We just have to look what actually occurs, and we see this universal result coming. So this is. this is all beta equals 2. I'm restricting myself to beta equals 2, but there are results now for beta equals 1 and 4, similar results, but only so far
beta equals 1
and 4 for this particular weight over here. This, as I've stated, this is a result of, as a mathematical result, of 5 people, DKM. DZ, that's myself, Krichabau, McLaughlin, Ben Achilles, and Joe. And the result up here with beta equals 1, this is beta equals 2, beta equals 1, it's myself with Dimitri Gioff. There's, of course, a big physics literature about it, and there are ways of seeing these things physically, but as I explained in the beginning, my inclination is towards mathematical results, so that's where I am. A different kind of result is the following. You ask, so in the case where you compute where Qn is just x squared, the Gaussian case, so I should put over here, Qn equals x squared, it's called the Gaussian unitary ensemble, GUE. These were computed in the 1960s, 1970s by Godin and Maeder. And the key fact, as we'll see when we go along, is this whole problem from a mathematical point of view, from an analytical point of view, is a question about the asymptotics of orthogonal polynomials, a subject we haven't mentioned yet. And because the orthogonal polynomials, in the Gaussian case, free Fermian case, if you want to say it that way, because in that case you're dealing with Hermite polynomials, and everything that you ever want to know about Hermite polynomials is available. One could prove a result of this kind, but when you look at more general weights, the even round x to the fourth, their own situations come completely different. One has to proceed in a different way. So if you're trying to get some kind of handle on what the analysis is that's going on behind it, the one thing which I'd ask you to fix in your mind is that from an analytical point of view, the problem you're going to be looking at is the asymptotics of orthogonal polynomials. That's the problem. So, different result is the probability. You take lambda 1, which is the largest eigenvalue, and you center it. I mentioned this result earlier. You divide by n to the sixth, less than equal to s. Look at the probability, the limit. So this is a result which is b. It's an edge result. Limit as n goes to infinity is equal to f of s, which has a beautiful form, e to the minus s to infinity, s t minus s, u squared t dt. U is a solution of the Panova 2 equation. This is Panova 2 equation. E to the minus, integral from s to 1/6, n to the 1/6, and u is normalized, looks like the Airy function as t goes to plus infinity. So, as I mentioned earlier, this is a solution of Panleve 5. This object here is essentially a solution of Panleve 2. And so, there's this beautiful explicit form on nonlinear equation and Panleve 2. It turns out it has a global, unique solution which looks like the Airy function when t goes to plus infinity. So this is eminently computable. This is called the Tracy-Widom distribution for the largest eigenvalue of a random unitary matrix. Again, you see the same phenomenon coming up. Once you've centered and scaled, the game is up. The answer you're going to get is completely independent of your choice of renormalization factor. There's no mention of W's, and this result is true in both cases. There's one little technical issue here, is that the edge of the spectrum will have some square root b behaving. It should look like, if this is the edge, 2 root n, this should behave like a lambda minus 2 root n to the power 3 over 2. This is a density of states. It should look like that. Generically, it's true. Over here? So it's e to the minus integral from s to infinity times t minus s u squared t dt. Beautiful form. Again, it's absolutely clear that what one is dealing with is a universality phenomenon within mathematics. Ultimately, as I said earlier, the question one is going to be looking at is the asymptotes of orthogonal polynomials. So what one is really seeing is the universality within the theory of orthogonal polynomials. So before we take a break, let me just outline how one would prove this. This will be a general outline which will follow in more detail in the next hour. So there are a number of steps. Step one, first express the statistics of interest. There is a gap probability, the probability that there are no eigenvalues in the gap. Notice that this is also a gap probability, because if I'm looking at this set here, I'm really looking at all lambda ones which are less than or equal to this number plus s times that scale. Just multiply things out. Which is saying that the largest eigenvalue is less than some. Which is the same thing as saying that there are no eigenvalues beyond that. So it's a gap probability. Beg your pardon?
How does one know that the scaling exponent is
non-zero? It's something which you have to, it only comes out of computation. As far as I know, there is no, well, I should stay stand back. Is that after taking one step back, we said also that if you play this game of patience, you're going to see exactly the same thing. It was known in the physics community that patience sorting game was in the same universality class as a lot of other phenomena. A large number of phenomena was known. So once one knew, so there was some scaling, whatever it is, it's going to be the same for all these different systems. Once you could determine it for this system, you then knew it for all the other in the same universality class. To the extent there's any physics which explains why one expects one particular value or not, I don't really know. But for us, it's just a computation. There was a lot of controversy about what the right scaling for the patient sorting problem was, but eventually it came out to be this. So now, first express the statistics of interest for us as a gap probability in terms of OPs, orthogonal polynomials. Next thing is convert the OP problem into a Riemann-Hilbert problem. I don't quite to say much more about this Riemann-Hilbert. And then use steepest descent non-commutative version. To extract the asymptotes. So that is the three steps. So, as I say, what one will show very early on is that these gap probabilities are expressible in terms of orthogonal polynomials. The question about the statistical behavior of these objects when n gets large then becomes a question about the asymptotes of orthogonal polynomials. If the polynomials you're looking at are classical, like Hermite, you're in good shape. You can just take what you know and apply it. However, if you're dealing with a weight like e to the minus x squared, e to the minus x to the fourth, you don't know what those are. So you've got to use other techniques. The other techniques are, go under the name of the Riemann-Hilbert problem, which I hope to persuade you is a non-commutative version of an integral representation. Just one is able to obtain in the end the asymptotics of orthogonal, say the Hermite polynomial, because you have an integral representation for it. And then you can use classical steepest descent on that integral to extract the behavior of the algebra. If you don't have such an integral representation, what do you do? Well, there is always a Riemann-Hilbert version, a Riemann-Hilbert picture, which is a sort of a non-commutative integral representation. And this is this picture is as amenable to asymptotic analysis as the ordinary integral representations are. And that's how the business goes. So let's take a break for 10 minutes. Okay, so question is how to actually prove these. And this is the outline over here. Okay, so let's start sort of first of all saying what is an orthogonal polynomial. So one starts off, which one has a measure, the mu of x, on R, and it has finite moments. Like that. And then what you do is you take 1x, x squared, and so on, these functions here, and you do Gram-Schmidt. And that will give you your polynomials pk of x, which are gamma k of x to the k, such that pk of x, the L of x, the mu of x, is equal to delta kl. KL bigger or equal to zero. So these are the orthogonal polynomials and these are the normalization coefficients. One often writes pk is equal to gamma k times pi k. The pi k of x is x to the k. It's a monic orthogonal polynomial with a constant. Yeah. Now, orthogonal polynomials have many properties, and the subject within mathematics going back probably about 250 years easily, and it has had different formulations. The modern formulation really in this form that one thinks you give you a measure and you construct the orthogonal polynomials with respect to that that measure, that's really something which was really pioneered or brought to the forefront by Zagel in the 1920s.
So just one matter of
computation. What is d mu?
It's some measure.
X to the n or not?
That d mu does not contain x to the n. D mu is just the measure, and I'm saying that if I multiply by x to the m, I'm just saying it's got finite moments. Now that's the normalization concept. If I just seen the pk's and the pi k's, so these are polynomials. So I've just pulled out the gamma k as a factor in front, and the leading term is 1 times x to the k. Okay, so you use the Gram-Schmidt procedure. So you start with function 1, then you take the function x. Start with a function 1, and then we'll say p0 of x is just the function 1. P0 of x is gamma 0 times a function to make sure that p0 squared, d mu, is the number 1.
That has nothing to do with the
other. No. It's just making sure that I can integrate any polynomial against the measure. So then, when I have that, the orthogonal polynomials famously satisfy a three-term recurrence relation. So there's which looks like this. I take pk plus 1 times bk plus ak pk of x plus bk minus 1 pk minus 1 of x, which is x times pk of x. And these numbers AK are real, and the BK is positive. It's called the three-term recurrence relation for the orthogonal polynomials.
So it's three-term because what? They satisfy a second-order differential equation?
Second-order differential equation, yeah. So all orthogonal polynomials have this property. Of course, special ones will satisfy differential equations with respect to x. That's special. This is a general feature for all orthogonal. Now, again, it's one of these really fascinating and extremely interesting facts that orthogonal polynomials show up really everywhere. And it's a subject that each generation of analysts sort of feels it's their obligation to write an obituary for orthogonal polynomials, saying that's what they did in the last generation or the generation before, only to find out that the answer to the very question they're looking at is page 17 in Zago's book on orthogonal polynomials. It's a subject like that. There are endless number of problems whose resolution has boiled down to, in recent times, it's boiled down to the properties of orthogonal polynomials. Okay. There are much deeper reasons which one can mention why orthogonal polynomials are so valuable and useful. But that's what they are. Now, the next fact is, what if suppose we compute the probability, so A is a number less than B, say, what's the probability that there are no eigenvalues in the interval AB? Everything I'm saying is true for unitary ensemble, the general unitary ensemble, Wn of x, dx, and unless I mention otherwise, everything is for that case. This turns out to be the following. The determinant, the identity, minus kn times the characteristic function of the interval ab. The k kernel looks like this. One is equal to pk of x times the root of w to the half power. So here is a formula. It's essentially due to Godin and Maida. And what you do, Sam, you ask this statistical question. And the answer is given by an operator whose kernel is expressed completely in terms of the orthogonal polynomials with respect to the weight W. So we've got dk, pl, wx, dx, wn. This is w is what I wrote, wn of x. Let me write like this, equals delta kl. Amazing fact. Now, the first question which arises, you see immediately now, if we are trying to look what happens when n gets large, what we have to do is say something about what is happening with the orthogonal polynomials when n is getting large. But you can say it's not a priori clearly just an asymptotic issue. It looks as if we need to know something about the orthogonal polynomials phi 0, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. It seems that we need to know something about all of it. But then a miracle occurs. There's a formula in orthogonal polynomials called the Christoffel-Dabou formula. And it tells us that kn of xy is equal to bn minus 1 times bn of x, bn minus 1 of y, minus bn of y, bn minus 1 of x, upon x minus y. So initially it looked as if this quantity here depended on all the polynomials, p0, p1, p2. If that were the case, you'd have no hope of proving a universality result. Because if that were true, the answer would depend, say, on the third polynomial, or the fourth polynomial, the fifth polynomial. And those are very specific to the weight. There is nothing a priori universal about the fifth polynomial. But what this is telling you is that this sum here can be effectively done. And all that matters is the behavior of the nth polynomial, the n minus first polynomial. And this bn minus 1 is this recurrence coefficient which is coming up here. So this is the real guts of the whole thing. If you want to see the asymptotics of this statistical quantity, it becomes a question about polynomials, but a question about the asymptotics of polynomials. Because all that comes in is the nth one and the n minus first, and n gets large. These are the polynomials with large order. And this is a coefficient which also will have asymptotic properties. So this formula here, together with this fact, is telling you that the question about the statistics of the gap is a question about the asymptotics of the orthogonal polynomial. So what kind of asymptotics? What kind of asymptotics? Something which is known in the orthogonal polynomial would be Chantre-Rotek asymptotics. So you don't just need to know about Pn of x. When x is fixed and n gets large, you need to know Pn of some scaling, let's call it beta n of x. So you must scale both the argument and the order. It's that kind of asymptotics, which is known as Chantre-Rotek. And for Hermite polynomials, or for Legendre polynomials, this was worked out in 1929 by Chantre-Rotek. And up until the late 1990s, that was all that was known about this asymptotics. One needed to... One knows now that one needs to apply the Riemann-Hilbert technique to get similar kind of asymptotics for general polynomials, general weights. So now, next thing is, what is a Riemann-Hilbert problem? The Riemann-Hilbert. So what you're given is this. The first thing you're given is a contour sigma, which is an oriented contour. In a complex plane. It can look like this. There's sigma, and attached to each arc is a direction. There is absolutely no consistency between these directions, nothing like that. You just, each one has got an orientation. And the convention is that if you move along an arc in the direction of the orientation, you say that the plus side of the arc lies to your left, the minus side lies to your right. It's a property of the arc. It's not a property of these regions, but so this would be the plus side of this arc and the minus side of that arc, plus and minus side. That's what we mean by an oriented contour. So it not only gives a sign to the arc, but of course it gives you an ability to integrate on such a thing, because you must integrate in the direction of the arc. And now they're all the arcs. The next thing you're given is what's called a jump matrix. And V is a map from the contour to the k by k invertible matrix. And you always have the assumption that V and V inverse are bounded. So these are the two objects, the contour and a matrix attached to each point on the contour, an invertible matrix, k by k matrix at each point. And we say that from sigma to the k, invertible matrices with complex entries. So if I take Z here, I get a matrix V of Z, which is an invertible K by K matrix. And in such a way that the norm doesn't blow up, the size of this matrix or its inverse doesn't blow up anywhere on the contour. So V and V and the inverse are bounded. Then we say that an L by K matrix function, M of Z, so it's an L by K matrix, is a solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem, sigma V, if M of Z is analytic, then C takes away the contour. So in other words, if we have our contour here, M of Z is an L by K, K matrix, and all the entries of the matrix are piecewise analytic. They're analytic in each of these six sectors. The next thing is that M plus of Z equals M minus of Z times V of Z. This is for Z on sigma. And M plus minus of Z is the limit as Z prime goes to Z from the plus or minus sign of M of Z prime. So in other words, if here is an arc oriented like that, so the plus side is here, the minus side is here, that's my Z. And if I take a Z prime there, which is on the plus side, I can evaluate M at that Z prime, and I can look at its boundary value as I come down to Z. that would be m plus of z. If I take point z prime on the minus side, and I look at the boundary value of m prime, m of z prime goes there, I get m minus of z. And this is telling me that m plus of z should be m minus of z times this jump matrix. It's a multiplicative jump. If I can find such a matrix, there might be many of them, which is L and L by K such matrix, I found a solution of the Riemann problem. And then if L equals K, so we're dealing with K by K, K matrices, and we say M of Z is a solution of the normalized problem if M of Z goes to the identity, K by K identity, and Z goes to Z. So one could imagine that there are many solutions. If there's one solution, if you can multiply it by a constant, you get a new solution. But if the matrices are square and they converge, M of Z goes to the identity matrix, we say it is a solution of the normalized Riemann. So this is a Riemann-Hilbert problem. I give you a contour, I give you a jump matrix. It goes back historically to Riemann and Hilbert. It was developed greatly in the former Soviet Union by many famous mathematicians. Krein, going back before then, Vekua, Mushkilashvili, many mathematicians. It's an extremely interesting problem mathematically. And it's really the first example coming up of actual Fredholm operator theory, not just operator 1 plus compact, but genuine Fredholm operator theory. I'm certainly not going to get into that now, but just to give you some sense is that there are many questions one has to ask, is that when I say I'm taking these limits, what do I mean by taking these limits? At each point, do I mean just a point-wise limit, or is it going to be a uniform point-wise limit? Is it for almost all points? What do I do with corners? When I say that M goes to the identity, what's the rate at which that happens? Has this problem got a solution? In what spaces has it got a solution? Is it unique? All questions like that. We're not going to deal with that, but I just want you to say that. If one wants to understand mathematically what this problem really is about, initially it looks like a problem about complex variables and how to take a matrix. And if you put the m minus on the other side, you invert it, you're saying v is equal to m minus inverse times m plus, so you're locally factorizing v into something which has an analytic continuation above times something with analytic continuation below. So it's something called a Riemann-Hilbert factorization problem. Looks like a complex variable problem. It can be, and most profitably, rewritten as a problem about integral equations on the contour. They're a system of integral equation on the contour, and they're singular integral equations because their kernel has got a singularity in it. In interesting cases, these turn out to be Fredholm operator equations, and the whole of Fredholm operator theory becomes available to you. That's the kind of mathematics one is dealing with. Now, the connection of all of this to our interests today really come from an observation of Forkash, Alexander Itz, and Kitaev, 1990. They're looking at a problem in 2D quantum gravity, and they along the way, made the following observation. Fix in let sigma be R, oriented from minus infinity to plus infinity. Let V of x equal 1, 0, 1, W. And we're in a situation we'll be looking at a measure d mu of x, which is w of x dx. Similar situation to what we had before. So to define this, is equal x belongs to R, which is our contour signal. And then let y, which I can emphasize depends on n, solve the Riemann-Hilbert problem. Sigma V. So that is y of z is analytic in C take away R. It's analytic above the line and analytic below the line. Y plus of z equals y minus of z times 1, 0, 1, W of z, which is just V of z. So z belonging to R. So it's a solution of this. It's 2 by 2. So Y is a 2 by 2 matrix solution. And we normalize it, not in the standard way, but Y of Z times Z to the minus N 0, 0, Z to the N goes to the identity. And Z goes. So suppose we've got a solution of that Riemann-Hilbert problem. This is a Riemann-Hilbert problem with a jump normalized in this particular way. Okay. Then, y of z is equal to pi n of z where pi n of z is the nth monic OP with respect to W dx, W dv. So immediately if you solve this Riemann-Hilbert problem, you look in the 1-1 entry, that is the nth monic orthogonal polynomial. This of course is the n minus first polynomial, gamma n minus 1, hat is just minus 2 pi I. Gamma n minus 1 squared. So this polynomial, if I replace n by n, n minus 1, has got a normalizing factor, gamma n, n minus 1. I take this combination, that's the number appears here. And this is the Cauchy transform. The CH of z is 1 upon 2 pi I times the integral along the contour of h of s ds. S minus Z, and this is for Z belonging to C take away R. So take a point off the contour, call it the point Z. You give me a function H of S, integrate this function times S minus Z. And that's the Cauchy transform, sometimes called the Borel transform. So in the 1-1 entry is the nth monic orthogonal polynomial. In the 1-2 entries, you multiply the nth monic orthogonal polynomial by this function w of x, and you take its Cauchy transform. So you replace h by this product. Do a similar thing here. And this is the solution of that Riemann-Hilbert problem. Moreover, if we write yn, we know the leading term when n gets larger is the 2 by 2 identity. It's a leading term. The next term will be a residue term, which I'll write in this way. And then there's an error of order z squared. That is, there you go. So this is the residue at infinity. And we find that gamma n minus 1 squared is minus 1 upon 2 pi y n 1 to 1 a n is y 1 n 1 1 y 1 n plus 1 1 1 b n y 1 n 1 2 y 1 n 2 1 and pi n is just y of n. Now, as we said, all the interesting quantities associated with orthogonal polynomials are the polynomials themselves, the recurrence coefficients an and bn, and the normalization constants gamma n. Those are all the objects of interest to orthogonal polynomials. Those are things you want to control and understand, and n becomes large. And what you're seeing from this formula is that all of these quantities of basic interest in orthogonal can all be read off from the solution of the Riemann Hilbert. Most of them just from this residue term sitting over here. So let me just give you a little bit of a feeling for how this goes. Now, this particular picture is what replaces the integral representation, say, for the Hermite functions, or the Hermite polynomials. Now, the oscillatory behavior, as we indicated along the way, there has to be some steepest descent or stationary phase time. As you're sitting a priori at infinity, when n gets large, this is oscillating or rotating very fast at infinity. You have to bring that in to bring it back from infinity and put in a finite part of the plane to begin your analysis. It's a whole big business to understand actually how to analyze this thing asymptotically. But for our purposes, yes, just enough for me to ask you to believe that when you have a situation like this, you can analyze this problem asymptotically to the same extent of detail as you can analyze the asymptotics of the Airy function or the asymptotics of the Hermite functions or the Laguerre function. But it's a non-commutative situation, and the techniques have to be greatly expanded. So let me just give you a little bit of a feeling how one comes to a thing like this, and how does this really work? So we've got this, y plus, y minus, and 1, 0, 1, so w of z. So let's just look at the first row. This is a statement which you can take row by row. This is y minus, right? So we've got y, 1, 1, y, 1, 2, plus, is equal to y, 1, 1, y, 1, 2, minus. And we've got this, that y, 1, 1, y12 times z to the minus n 0 0 z to the n goes to 1 0. In other words, y11 z to the minus n goes to 1, and y12 z to the n goes to 0 as z gets large. That's the problem, complex variable problem that we want to solve. So if we multiply this out, we see that we have y11 plus equals y11 minus. Y11 is analytic above the line, it's analytic below the line. Now we're seeing that there's no jump across the line. Boundary value from the top equals the boundary value from the bottom. And that immediately implies of Y11 is in time. Analytic everywhere, it has no jump. On the other hand, what this is telling us, Y11, V to the minus N goes to 1. So we know that Y11 must necessarily then be a polynomial exactly of degree N. So these things apply. Apply that Y11 of V is a poly, is a monic polynomial of degree N. So Y11 equals V to the N. Now we look at the next entry over there. So Y12 plus equals Y12 minus plus W times Y11 minus. Just multiplying out this. First of all, Y11 is analytic, so it doesn't matter whether we put plus or minus. Now we're saying that the jump Y12 has got an additive jump. Now, a problem like this, where the Y12 certainly goes to zero, N is positive. We're saying that Y12 times E to the N goes to zero, so Y12 must go to zero. At least as little o of 1 over z to the n. So this can be solved by a famous formula. Y12 of z is the Cauchy transform, let's put it this, the Cauchy transform of W of s times Y11 of s ds upon 2 pi r. So this is just the Cauchy transform. By W times Y11. There's a famous formula. In fact, what you can see is that C plus, in other words, the boundary value of this from the plus side, minus the boundary value of this from the minus side, is just the identity. So this is saying the boundary value from the plus side minus the boundary value from the minus side is just the identity acting on that. So this is a famous formula in complex variable. You can just check that indeed, if I have this and I compute the boundary value from the top and the bottom, what I'm going to get is, it's just a property in the end of the Poisson kernel. So I'll leave it like that. So now we see that the 1-1 entry is some polynomial. On the other hand, the Y12 is this Cauchy transform value. Where do we see that Y11 is not just any polynomial, but actually the orthogonal polynomial with respect to the measure being? This is the guts of the matter. And we see that this is true. We've got that Y12 times V to the N goes to zero. So in other words, Y12 is little o, it's a big O, for V to the N plus 1. So now if we take this and write it, pull it out like this, minus 1 over Z, and we've got here 1 upon 1 minus S over Z. Pull out the z from here. Then I expand this. And I get minus 1 over z. We've got here 1 plus s over z, s squared over z squared, s to the n upon z to the n, and wy11, s upon 2 pi r. Now this Y12 has to be of order 1 over z to the n. So all all of these contributions here will give me a decay like 1 over z, 1 over z squared. All of them are bad, because the final decay should be like this. So what has to happen is that integral s to the j times wy11 ds should be 0 for all j between 0 and n minus 1. So that all these terms drop out and just this last one is left, so that I get a behavior of 1 over z to the n plus 1. So if you look at this property, it's just saying that this polynomial, which is of degree n, is orthogonal to all polynomials of lower degree, and hence y11 is just the nth. So it's encoded, the fact that you're dealing with the nth polynomial with respect to that measure, W dec is encoded in the second condition. Then you can check what's going on in the second row. So I just want to end with a little bit about the asymptotics. So the story, as we have told it, is that interesting statistics can be expressed in for these kind of ensembles can be expressed in terms of orthogonal polynomials. The kind of problem is an asymptotic problem for these orthogonal polynomials. How do you get these asymptotics? In special cases, you could use integral representations, but in general, you can't. But what you can use in general is this Riemann-Hilbert representation. And that leaves the big question, how do you get the asymptotics out of it? Now, it's a big, long story. It's many more lectures than we have, but I just want to say a little bit. The CPCN method for Riemann-Hilbert problems introduced by Jin Zhou and myself in the early 1990s. There, one is interested, for example, he could be interested in the NLS equation. The NLS equation looks like this: IQT plus QXX plus, say, minus 2 mod Q squared Q equals 0. And we've got some initial data, function of 0, NLS equation. Now, key question is, how do solutions of the NLS equation behave when t becomes large? Do they behave just like solutions of the free equation? Or is there something else going on? It turns out they don't behave like the free equation. There's a long-range interaction taking place, and which must be taken into account. But it turns out, going back to the work of Zakharov and Shabbat in the mid-1970s, or early 1970s, that there is that this is a completely integrable system, and that turns out to have the implication, after the work of Shabbat, that it could be represented by a Riemann-Hilbert problem. So you take your Riemann-Hilbert problem R, you take your contour again to be R, and for your jump matrix, you freeze X and T. So X and T fixed. And you introduce the following. You take 1 minus R of Z squared, and you take R e to the I theta minus R bar e to the minus I theta times 1. Theta is XZ plus T Z squared. X and T are frozen. And you're interested in the solution of that equation at some time x. Now R of Z is a reflection coefficient associated with the initial data Q0 of x. So there are, for people who know such things, it's an integrable system. There is a scattering problem associated with it. And just as the same as in the Schrödinger case, there is a reflection coefficient associated with the Schrodinger case. Now there is a reflection coefficient associated with that linear scattering gapping problem. You give me Q0, I can find the R of B. Now you look at this Riemann-Hilbert problem, and we let MZ XT solve to be normalized Riemann-Hilbert problem. Sigma dxt. So x and t are frozen. M of z is an analytic function in z above the line, above below the line. Its jump, m plus equals m minus times is v. And it's normalized. So m goes to the identity when z gets large. Then one can compute the residue for this problem. And you find that so M is looks like identity plus M1 over XT upon Z plus order 1 over Z squared and Z gets large. So M solves a normalized Riemann-Hilbert problem. And then one finds that if you multiply, I think, by 2i, maybe minus I, I forget the exact constant, because M1 of XT is the one true entry. And that's the solution of that. Absolutely remarkable fact is that you take this complex variable problem, this factorization problem, and you solve it, and you extract information from the solution, and that information, that residue information, is the solution of NKD. NLS. Now, one should think about this as a single unit, as a picture of the NLS equation. One should think of it as being an analog of what would, say, be an integral representation for the solution of the linear problem. Just as you would have for the linear problem, you'd have a representation e to the r theta times q hat 0 kvk or zdz is a Fourier transform of the initial data. E to the r theta is what I have here, and this would be the solution of the linear problem. Instead of having this integral representation, you have this picture. This would be empty words if you couldn't extract as much information about this as you can about that. The fact is, you can. And just as the main contribution here is coming from the stationary phase point, which is the point x plus 2t z0 equals 0, so z0 is minus x over 2t, the main contribution here comes from there. Exactly the same thing happens over here. But instead of the contribution coming from a little integral around there, now what happens, so over here, in the classical case, the problem localizes in the z variable around that point. We just left it a little Gaussian integral around that. We're all familiar with this calculation. Now what happens is that this Riemann-Hilbert problem localizes to a little Riemann-Hilbert problem around the point z0, which can be solved explicitly in the other. But then this is the beginning. Then you could have, this is the simplest case. So you then have the complete analog of the stationary phase method in this non-commutative situation. Now you could have the analog of other phenomena which occur, say, in optics. One knows that if one has two stationary phase points, as long as they're separated, they act independently to leading order. But as these two points come together, you can have an interaction of these stationary phase points, and you get the phenomenon of caustics. That is also found in these kind of problems. If you take MKdV, modified KdV, and theta is replaced by theta hat, which is F0 plus Tz cubed. Now your stationary phase points are given by 3tz squared equals 0, so z equals plus or minus square root of minus x over 3t. if your region, if in a region x over t is bounded away from 0, you've got two stationary phase points, plus and minus. But if you're in a region of space, space time, where x is of small order compared to t, these two stationary points come together, and you get a nonlinear version of caustics. It turns out that the behavior in that region of space time is described by a self-similar solution of the equation, which is exactly given by a solution of the Panovay two equation, the Panovay two equation. So the phenomena of linear optics are reflected in these problems. At this point, new phenomena begin to arise. Now one is a completely different situation, wherein instead of having, say, five stationary points, some of them coming together, now you get into a situation which is completely unique to the nonlinear situation we are looking at. Where instead of having stationary phase points, you have stationary phase lines. So you get contributions, equal contributions, not just from a point or a finite number of points, but from all the points on some interval. They all contribute equally. And this has the effect of giving rise to genuinely nonlinear oscillations. So I mean by linear oscillations, we would have that you find it's, for example, a solution of this, this equation will look like sine of theta x over t times x plus alpha x over t phase gamma, maybe the t to some power alpha. So these are modulated sine waves. These are linear oscillations which are modulated. So when t gets large, this is what the solution looks like. Same for modified KdV when x over t is not going to zero. So one says in a situation like this, one is just getting modulated linear oscillations. But now a new phenomenon begins to happen. So instead of having just contributions from single phase points, you get contributions from a whole line equally. And instead of having sine, you now are replaced by the Jacobian SN function, the CSN, or more generally theta function. So you begin to have what are called genuinely non-linear oscillations. And let me just end up by saying that eventually, when we go back to our orthogonal polynomial problem, in the end, instead of having contributions coming just from one point, we now find that the contribution comes from an interval, minus 1 to 1. And you must solve the following Riemann-Hilbert problem, m plus, m minus, some 0, 1, minus 1, 0. The leading order behaviors extracted out of this final Riemann. How you get to this Riemann-Hilbert problem where all points are contributing equally is a whole long story. But let me leave it at that. So I'll stop at this point.